So, welcome everybody. This is the first lecture in my course Tranquility and Insight in Early Buddhist Discourse. And this year, as you are probably already seeing, we have our guest of honor again. Bhikkhu Bodhi is here. So I'm just going to briefly introduce the course and him, and then it will all be in the hand of Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. This semester we are taking up the 7th chapter of the Madhyama Agama. We have been jumping two chapters, chapter 5 and 6, because the translation project that we are working on at Numata was ready for that part, and we are expecting it to come out soon. Thus, we decided that for the course in 2013, we'll take up a new chapter that is not going to be published very soon. And the main topic in that chapter is Tranquility and Insight. This is not a theme consistently mentioned in all of the discourses, but it is something that comes up again and again as a basic topic, and we are very fortunate that in order to get us going on this topic, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has agreed on giving us some basic ideas. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi is an American monk who was originally born in New York, and he has a PhD in philosophy from Claremont Graduate School. After completing his university studies, he traveled to Sri Lanka, where he received novice ordination in 1972 and full ordination in 1973 under the Sri Lankan scholar monk Venerable Balangoda Ananda Maitreya, with whom he studied Pali and Buddhism. From 1984 until 2002, he was the editor of the Buddhist Publication Society in Kandy, and he was also its president from 1988 to 2010. He also attended upon the famous German monk Venerable Nyanaponika Thera during the last 10 years of his life. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi is probably known to all of you as a translator of the middle-length discourses, the connected discourses, and finally this year also of the numerical discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, and also of several important articles and commentaries on the Pali Suttas. He lives and teaches now at Chuang Yin Monastery in upstate New York, and since 2008 he, together with several of his students, has founded the Buddhist Global Relief, a non-profit organization supporting hunger and poverty relief for communities suffering from chronic hunger and malnutrition around the world. This is as much as I have to say. Now I hand over to Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi for introducing us into the topic of serenity and insight, or tranquility and insight. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for that introduction, Venerable Analeo. And I'm very honored to be giving the first talk in... I didn't click my red button. Okay, I thank you very much for that introduction, Venerable Analeo, and I'm very honored to be giving the first class in this series on the Madhyama Agama. I remember back in the 1990s when I was giving weekly Dharma talks at the Buddhist Publication Society. For a certain period, a young, newly ordained German monk was coming to sit in on my classes. And in those days, I used to think, he don't know nothing about Buddhism. But just starting to study, and now he's learned so many languages, and he's gotten a PhD and a habilitation in Buddhist studies, and is a professor at University of Hamburg, and Bhikkhu Bodhi is still giving weekly lectures in the monastery. Okay, so I'm going to be giving a kind of overview on Samatha and Vipassana, in the Pali tradition or in the early Buddhist tradition, basing my presentation mainly on the Pali Nikayas, the discourses that the Buddha preserved in the Pali language. And before I actually enter into the specific topics relating to Samatha and Vipassana, I want to give a sketch of what I call the doctrinal underpinnings of Buddhist meditation, because we can't just take Buddhist meditation practices out of their proper setting within the broader framework of Buddhist teaching. But we have to see where these practices fit into the landscape of Buddhist practice and what kinds of purpose they're intended to serve within this framework of the Buddhist teaching. And as we know, the most fundamental, the most comprehensive teaching of the Buddha is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. So if we're going to find a place for Samatha and Vipassana in the Buddhist teachings, we would have to locate them someplace in relation to the Four Noble Truths. Probably all of you have come across the Four Noble Truths, and you know that these are the truths of suffering, or dukkha, the cause of suffering, which is the second noble truth, which the Buddha identifies with craving. With then the third noble truth is the noble truth of the cessation or the ending of suffering, which the Buddha explains as the ending or cessation of that craving that causes suffering. And then the fourth noble truth is the truth of the way or path to the ending of suffering, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path. Now there's two ways, or at least I've discerned two ways, in which to understand the Four Noble Truths. One of these I call a vertical interpretation, and the other a horizontal interpretation. The vertical interpretation of the Four Noble Truths treats them primarily as a kind of existential or psychological disclosure of centered around the problem of suffering as we face it in this very life. So here we could see dukkha, the truth of dukkha, as referring to our personal and existential dissatisfaction, sorrow, anxiety, worry, grief, misery, dejection, despair, and so on. And then when we are seeking a cause for that suffering, we find it in our own present craving, and the release from this type of suffering comes from abolishing, eliminating, and removing that craving. And this is done again through the Four Noble Truths. And we could see some examples of this in the early Buddhist texts, some texts which exemplify this understanding of dukkha. For example, one such text comes in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Gamini Samyutta. It's chapter 42, sutta number 11, where a village chieftain named Bhadraka comes to the Buddha and asks to be taught about suffering. And here the Buddha says, if I were to teach you about suffering with reference to the past, you might have doubts and uncertainty. If I were to teach you about suffering in relation to the future, again you might have doubts and uncertainty. And so the Buddha says, while you are sitting in your seat there, and I am sitting in my seat here, I'm going to teach you about the arising and ceasing of suffering right here and now. And then the Buddha asks them about the people that he has attachment to, and he says that he has attachment to his beloved wife and his dear only son. And so then the Buddha says to him, if something were to happen to your wife or to your son, wouldn't you feel, some shame, some if they were to be sick, injured, or killed? Wouldn't you experience sorrow, grief, lamentation, pain, and misery? And Bhadraka says, yes. Then the Buddha says, and what about the people that you have no attachment to? You know, just complete strangers. If anything were to happen to them, would you feel this sorrow, grief, and misery? And Bhadraka says, no. And so then the Buddha draws out the principle and says, you see, whatever suffering arises, arises because of your attachment, your craving, your desire. Okay, so that makes clear to Bhadraka how his present suffering or his vulnerability to suffering is contingent on his present craving. We also see examples of this in a number of suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha is speaking to interrogators, to wanderers who come to him and ask him to teach them about suffering. And here the Buddha says that, or explains to them that whatever suffering arises in them arises because they have lust, hatred, and delusion. This is something they could see for themselves right here and now, right in this present life. And they could also understand if they were to be free of lust, free of hatred, free of delusion, they wouldn't have any suffering right here and now. So this, we could say, is a Dita Dhammika presentation of the Four Noble Truths. That is, it's a presentation which is visible right here and now. But there is another interpretation of the Four Noble Truths, which is what I call the horizontal interpretation. From this perspective, the Four Noble Truths can be seen as laying out an account of what I call the causal dynamics, the underpinnings of samsara, the round of birth and death. From this point of view, we focus not so much on suffering as being equivalent to sorrow, pain, grief, misery, and despair, but rather as dukkha, consisting in the five aggregates bound up with clinging. And here we find that the origin of dukkha is craving, understood as ponobhavika, as craving that is conducive to renewed existence, craving as that which leads to repeated becoming, repeated existence. And so from this point of view, it is the craving in any given life, craving accompanied by the other defilements, the craving which manifests in the form of attachment to life, enjoyment of this or that object of attachment, this craving that brings about a renewal of the five aggregates in the next life, and then on the basis of those five aggregates, new craving arises, which generates more defiled activity, more accumulations of karma, which bring about still another existence beyond that in the future. So in this way, you can see that there's an interplay between craving and the five aggregates, so that the craving of one life brings about the combination of the five aggregates, or the compound of the five aggregates in the next life. On the basis of those five aggregates, more craving arises, which propels the renewal of the cycle of becoming in still another life, and thus the process goes on from one life to the next, to the next, to the next. And that is what we call samsara, the unbroken stream of existences, or continuum of existences, following one another, consisting in the five aggregates, and driven by craving. This aspect of the Four Noble Truths is brought out more explicitly, more clearly, and more explicitly in the formula of dependent origination, the 12 links of dependent origination, which might be considered a more elaborate or a more detailed exposition of the Four Noble Truths. And I'm not going to go into all 12 stages or all 12 factors of dependent origination here, since that would be virtually a lecture in itself. But I just want to focus in on a few key factors within this formula. The formula, I'll pick up the formula at the end, where all of the 12 factors are now culminating in old age and death, which might be considered the quintessential manifestation of dukkha. Then in the sequence of conditions, the Buddha traces old age and death to birth, since if we weren't born, we wouldn't have to go through old age and death. And birth depends upon those activities, those actions, which create a propensity towards new existence in the future. So that is what is meant by bhava, renewed existence, the accumulation of activities precipitating or projecting new existence. That those activities that constitute bhava depend upon clinging, especially the clinging to the five aggregates, with the idea that they are I and mine. Clinging in turn is, we could say, it's an intensification of craving. So here we come back to the second noble truth, and craving in turn ultimately depends upon ignorance, which is the first link in the 12 factors of dependent origination. And so the fundamental challenge for Buddhism is, we could say, at one level, it's to overcome craving, because craving is the origin or cause of suffering. But since craving depends upon ignorance, and ignorance is the deeper cause that underlies craving, we could say that a more basic challenge is to overcome ignorance, or to replace ignorance, avijja, with correct cognition, vijja, or with wisdom, penetrating wisdom, panya. Okay, now the nature, again, to see where samatha and vipassana fit into the Buddha's path, we have to look a little more deeply at the nature of ignorance. And I see, by putting together numbers of suttas, ignorance as having two aspects, what I call a negative aspect and a positive or constructive aspect. The negative aspect is the way ignorance conceals or hides things. And from this aspect, we could say that ignorance is unknowing, or unjnana, the absence of knowledge. It's the function of ignorance here is to cover up or conceal the true nature of phenomena, so that we don't understand things as they really are. We don't see the Four Noble Truths. We don't see dependent origination. We don't see the three characteristics. But ignorance also has a positive aspect. Positive not in the sense of wholesome or worthy of approval, but rather an active aspect. And here we could say that ignorance creates certain perceptual and conceptual distortions. So instead of seeing things as they really are, we see things, conceive of them, interpret them in distorted and deluded ways. And the text mentioned three particular ways in which ignorance distorts our perception and our conception. That is, we take what is really impermanent to be lasting or permanent. We take what is really unsatisfactory to be a source of satisfaction, a source of happiness. And we take what is really not self, not truly my essence, the core of my being, to be myself, to be a true personal essence, to be the core of my being. And so in this double role as concealing the true nature of things and as projecting false, distorted conceptions about the nature of things, ignorance serves as the linchpin for all the other defilements of the mind, particularly and most decisively, craving. And then out of that craving, working in conjunction with ignorance, there comes the round of rebirths with all the associated dukkha, or suffering of repeated birth, old age, sickness, and death, as well as sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. Okay, so when we see that the fundamental cause of all suffering at the deepest level of ignorance, then we could see why the Buddha has organized his practical teaching according to a particular pattern. And this pattern is perhaps expressed most concisely in the threefold training. And to see how the threefold training links to the causation of suffering, we begin not with the first training, but with the third training. The third training is the training in wisdom, or panya. And the reason why the training culminates in wisdom is because wisdom is the antidote to ignorance. In order to eliminate ignorance, one needs panya, or wisdom. So panya, wisdom, is what brings vijja, true understanding, true cognition, and it is that true cognition that will eradicate ignorance. And the specific training for generating wisdom is the training in vipassana, in insight meditation. But now, according to the Buddha, insight, true insight, wisdom, can't arise in a mind that's scattered, distracted, and covered over, clouded with many distracting defilements. And so in order to train the mind to make it a fit instrument for giving rise to real wisdom, one has to develop concentration, or samadhi. Samadhi is a state in which the mind is collected, focused, able to remain persistently on its object, on its objective field. And it's when the mind has acquired this ability to focus in closely on its object and to remain steadily focused on its object, it's in that condition that wisdom can arise. And to bring the mind into that state of samadhi, one has to undertake the training that leads to samadhi. And that training is the training in samatha, or serenity or tranquility, the training by which one draws in the scattered and distracted mind, keeps it focused on its object, and enables the mind to settle down and become quiet, still, and observant of its object. So this is why the Buddha makes the second field of training, the training in what is called sometimes the training in samadhi, or the training in adhicitta, the higher type of mind, the mind of concentration. In order for the mind, though, to reach the state of concentration, it has to be free from the rather coarse disturbances that come from moral transgression, from acting in violation of the fundamental principles of ethics or morality. So for this reason, the Buddha makes the basis of the training in virtuous behavior or sila. So thus we get the threefold training, starting with the foundation of virtuous conduct. On the basis of virtuous conduct, one normally proceeds to train the mind to focus on its object, to become collected, concentrated, and still. That is the training in samatha, serenity or tranquility. And then on that basis, one proceeds to train the mind to develop insight wisdom. And that is the practice of vipassana, the training in insight meditation. Okay, so more broadly, we could say when the Buddha is laying out his path to the cessation of suffering, he explains it as the Noble Eightfold Path. And so we have right view. We have the Noble Eightfold Path beginning with right view and right intention, then moving on to right speech, right action, right livelihood, and then moving beyond that to right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So in this formula of the path, we begin with a conceptual right view, a right view by which one is able to understand intellectually or conceptually the principles of the Buddha's teaching, especially the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, the three marks of existence. Then based on the right view, one has to set the mind in the right direction, which is right intention, particularly the intention towards renunciation or the absence of sensual desire, in the direction of non-ill will or benevolence towards all beings, and the direction of harmlessness, non-injury towards all beings. So from these right intentions, one then moves into virtuous conduct or sila through the three factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And then going beyond that, one trains to develop samadhi or concentration through right effort and right mindfulness, leading to samasamadhi, right concentration. So these factors, 6, 7, and 8, we could say form the training in samatha or serenity. But the achievement of right concentration is not the end of the Noble Eightfold Path. Though it's the eightfold, it's the eighth factor, it also has to serve as a basis for a higher type of right view, which is the experiential right view, which comes through contemplation, through mindfulness and observation of the phenomena of body and mind. And so here, right concentration is giving rise to insight, the right view of insight. And that right view of insight is the work of vipassana. So it's transforming through the practice of vipassana one transforms right view from a conceptual or intellectual understanding to an experiential understanding, and that personal or direct insight is vipassana. Okay, so this is what we would call the classical model of the path, either the training going from sila and to samadhi to panya, virtuous behavior, to concentration, to wisdom, or in the Noble Eightfold Path, beginning from conceptual understanding to virtuous behavior, to concentration, to experiential insight. But now I want to look at a number of texts from the Pali Suttas which discuss samatha and vipassana and speak about their relationship to each other. First, though, I should take the words samatha and vipassana, which, if you go down in your handout to the title of this section, Selected Suttas on Samatha and Vipassana, you'll see those words in Pali. And it might seem superficially, but I've seen a number of people make this mistake of thinking that there is somehow a verbal connection between the word samatha and the word samadhi, but that would be a misunderstanding. The word samadhi, I don't know if there's a way to write onto this.
Not really, Bhante.
Okay, the word samadhi is from the prefix sam, S-A-M, plus another prefix, a, the long A, plus the stem, V, D-H-I. So samadhi means, the stem D means to put or to place. Some suggests together, and the prefix A also suggests bringing in. So bringing in together and placing the mind on its object. Or more loosely, we could say it's the collecting of the mind, the focusing of the mind. But the stem here is D, which comes from the verbal root da, to place. The word samatha has no relation at all to samadhi, verbally, but it comes from the root sam, which means to become peaceful, to become calm. And then samatha just indicates the state of calmness, or so we could say loosely, tranquility or serenity. The word vipassana is based on the verb pasati, which means to see. And so from the verb pasati, to see, we get a noun pasana, which means seeing. And then in front of that word seeing, we have a prefix V, which could have the meaning visesa, which means excellent or special. So vipassana is special seeing or excellent seeing. Or more loosely, we could say it's deep and clear seeing. So we render this in English as insight. So often, the Buddha emphasized the importance of practicing both serenity and insight. And I've taken a number of texts which illustrate this. I think before I take, I'm not going to take the text exactly in the order in which I place them there, but I want to jump down to on page 4 of the handout, to a text from the Anguttara Nikaya. This is from the Book of Twos in the Anguttara Nikaya, the title that I've given to this is Serenity and Insight. It's Book of Twos, Sutta number 31. The text here says, monks, these two things pertain to true knowledge. The Pali is bija bhagya dhamma. So bija is true knowledge, which is the opposite of avijja, ignorance. So both serenity and insight are things that participate in or pertain to true knowledge. So he says, what are these two? Serenity and insight, samatha and vipassana. Then he asks, when serenity is developed, what benefit does one experience? The benefit is that the mind is developed. Then what is the benefit of developing the mind? The benefit is lust is abandoned. Now I think this statement has to be taken in two senses. And here I'll be giving my own interpretation, which is rooted in the commentarial tradition. When one is developing samatha alone, concentration alone, one overcomes and abandons the five hindrances, including as the first hindrance, sensual desire or sensual lust, kamachanda or kamaraga. But this is not a final and ultimate abandoning of sensual lust, but it's a temporary abandoning which comes because the mind has been developed into a particular state, a state of deep concentration in which sensual lust does not arise, or at least while that samadhi is maintained, the sensual lust doesn't gain an opportunity to arise. But it's only when the serenity, the samatha, is developed in conjunction with vipassana that the lust will be cut off at the root so that it doesn't arise again. Okay, now when insight is developed, the question is raised, what benefit does one experience? Okay, when one develops insight, cultivates insight, then wisdom is developed. This is panya. So insight, we could say, is, or vipassana, is the practice, the method of cultivation, which will bring into being wisdom or panya. And then when wisdom is developed, what benefit does one experience? The benefit is that ignorance is abandoned. Okay, when one is developing wisdom through insight, one is gradually, as the insight is deepening, one is starting to see into the impermanence of all the conditioned phenomena. One sees more clearly that because these phenomena are impermanent, they are dukkha or unsatisfactory, and because they're impermanent and unsatisfactory or insecure, they are not to be identified with as I or mine, not to be taken as myself. So with that, one is abandoning the delusions of permanence, pleasure, and self in regard to conditioned phenomena, in regard to the five aggregates. So one is starting to chip away at this ignorance. But even with the development of ignorance, with the development of insight up to a certain point, one is not yet eradicating ignorance, but one is still just developing the kind of temporary abandonment of ignorance, but it's when serenity and insight reach a certain peak of cultivation, a certain threshold, that they merge together and bring the arising of the supramundane path or the world transcending path. And it's within that path in which serenity and insight are joined that one starts to eliminate and to eradicate totally the fetters of sensual lust and the fundamental fetter of ignorance. Okay, and so here, just continuing with the sutta, the Buddha says, a mind defiled by lust is not liberated, and wisdom defiled by ignorance is not developed. Or I would actually rephrase this to say that, okay, when the mind is defiled by lust, then the mind is certainly not liberated. And when the mind is defiled by ignorance, then the wisdom is not developed. That makes better sense to me than speaking about wisdom being defiled by ignorance. Okay, but then the Buddha goes on to say that it is through the fading away of lust that there is liberation of mind, and through the fading away of ignorance that there is liberation by wisdom. Now what we speak about in Buddhism is the final liberation, which is the liberation of the arhat, has two aspects, which are called chaito-vimutti and panya-vimutti. Chaito-vimutti is what's translated as liberation of mind, and panya-vimutti is what's translated as liberation by wisdom. And now there can be temporary states of liberation of mind. For example, the liberation of mind in somebody who has achieved the jhanas without developing wisdom. This can be a chaito-vimutti. Sometimes it would be in the fourth jhana, it would be called, I think, the dukkha-sukha. Chaito-vimutti, the liberation of mind without, that's not pleasant or painful. Or somebody who develops the divine abodes, the Brahma-viharas, could have the metta chaito-vimutti, the liberation of mind by loving kindness. And in these states, lust and the other coarse defilements have faded away temporarily, in that they're not obsessing the mind, but they're not yet eradicated. But it's when the liberation of mind through serenity is yoked with the liberation by wisdom that lust is completely abandoned and ignorance is completely abandoned. And so one could say that it is through the prior development of samadhi that the lust is first temporarily overcome and then finally eradicated, and it's through the development of wisdom that ignorance is totally eradicated. So this is why we speak of the final liberation of the arhat as being simultaneously a liberation of mind and a liberation by wisdom. And both aspects of that liberation, or those two aspects of liberation, are the fruit, respectively, of the development of samatha and the development of vipassana. In other words, the development of serenity and insight. Okay, now how does one develop serenity and insight? When I was explaining the three trainings, I spoke about how one progresses from virtuous behavior or sila to samadhi, which is reached through the practice of samatha, and then one progresses to the development of wisdom through the practice of vipassana, or insight. And similarly, when I spoke about the development of the Noble Eightfold Path, I also indicated that samadhi, the training in samadhi, is the basis for the training in experiential wisdom. But when we look at the suttas, we see that there are different texts which explain the sequence of training in different ways, because the Buddha had to teach disciples with many different temperaments, different inclinations, different practices in their previous lives, with different faculties at different degrees of strength. And so he would vary his method of instruction to fit the specific need of the disciple. So we can say that the general paradigm is that of sila, samadhi, panya, or moving from virtuous behavior to the practice of serenity, to the practice of insight. But here we're going to look at a short sutta spoken by the Buddha's disciple Ananda, in which the Buddha speaks in which Ananda explains how disciples who have reached arhatship have taken different paths or different sequences of training to the final goal. So here Ananda is speaking to the monks, and he says, whatever bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, monk or nun, has declared anya, that's final knowledge or the attainment of arhatship in my presence, they have all done so by these four paths, these four methods, or one amongst them. So what are these four paths, the four types of sequence that they follow? So Ananda starts here, a monk develops insight preceded by serenity. This is samatha pubangamang vipassana. So in this Pali statement, samatha, serenity, is the forerunner, and vipassana comes afterwards. And so that's why he develops first serenity, then insight. Then as he is developing serenity first and then insight, at a certain point, the path is generated. This is speaking about the world-transcending path, or the Lokuttara, the supermundane Noble Eightfold Path. So then once the path arises, then this disciple repeatedly pursues this path, develops it, cultivates it, and as he does so, then he abandons the fetters and eradicates the underlying tendencies. This is referring to as he develops the four supramundane stages of the path. Step by step, he eliminates the 10 fetters and uproots the 7 underlying tendencies. We don't have to take these in detail now, but the important point from this explanation is that in this model, or according to this paradigm, one develops serenity or samadhi to a certain point, then one leaves off the samadhi and starts to cultivate insight. And so that samadhi is serving as the basis for the insight. And when samadhi, when the insight reaches a certain level of strength, then backed up by that prior development of serenity, the insight becomes adequate for generating the world-transcending path. So we could say that this is the model that we see exemplified by the threefold training and the general way of explaining the Noble Eightfold Path. But here we have in step 2 a different model of the practice. Here, Ananda speaks about a monk who develops serenity preceded by insight. In Pali, this is Vipassana Pubangamang Samatang Bhaveti. Then as he is developing serenity preceded by insight, the path, the supramundane path is generated, or the world-transcending path arises. Then he repeatedly pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are abandoned, and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Okay, now, according to this model, and this is one which sometimes requires more interpretation than the previous one, so I have to explain the way I understand it. I take this to be the model of a practice which begins with direct contemplation of material and mental phenomena. I take this to be the model, for example, that is taught in some of the contemporary systems of insight that have emanated from Burma and that are now practiced widely in other parts of the world. So in this model, one doesn't begin by developing samadhi to the level of the jhanas or deep absorption, but one begins by contemplating with mindfulness the material and mental phenomena. And now, it might seem like those who want to criticize this model say that you can't have insight without samadhi. The Buddha says, one who you should develop samadhi, because one who has samadhi understands things or sees things as they really are. And so from that statement, they say, well, you need samadhi in order to gain insight, so you can't begin gaining insight before you have samadhi. But I think that criticism misunderstands this particular model of practice. In this model of practice, one begins by noting bodily and mental phenomena. Usually one will begin with a certain anchor point. It could be the rise and fall of the abdomen. It could be the touch sensation of the breath coming in and out around the nostrils. It could be the sensation, the physical sensations in the body. It could be the marks or characteristics of the four elements that one experiences in the body. But one is attending to the characteristics of these bodily phenomena. Then when certain feelings arise, one attends to the feelings. When thoughts arise, one attends to the thoughts. When memories arise, one attends to the memories. When plans for the future arise, one notes these plans. And so one is attending to, observing these bodily and mental phenomena, noting their characteristics as they are occurring in the present. And as one practices in this way, the attention becomes more and more finely focused on the present moment, on what is occurring in the present moment. And so the mind is becoming stabilized in the present. And as one does so, insight starts to arise into the impermanence of all these bodily and mental phenomena. Because the mind is focused on these phenomena, one is seeing with each in and out breath, with each rise and fall of the abdomen, with each sensation in the body, one is seeing bodily and mental phenomena arise and pass away, arise and pass away in very rapid succession. And so one is now starting to see into the impermanence of these phenomena. And so a kind of samadhi is developed along with the development of insight. And that samadhi is actually forming the basis for that insight to arise, the actual insight knowledges to arise. But because one begins with direct observation of bodily and phenomena, rather than by stabilizing the mind first on a single object, it says that one is developing insight, one is developing serenity preceded by insight. And for such meditators, it might be necessary, in order for them to reach the supramundane path, it might be necessary for them at certain points in their development of insight to lay their practice of insight aside and then attend to strengthening their practice of samadhi. And when they strengthen their practice of samadhi, then they can return to the development of insight. And it's through the stronger cultivation of insight that they will eventually reach the supramundane path, the world-transcending path. Okay, now we come to the third system, or third model of practice. And this is said to be, or Ananda says, in this case, a monk or any practitioner develops serenity and insight in conjunction. And he here uses a rather unusual expression. He says that the monk develops samatha vipassanam yuga nadang bhaveti. The word yuga nadang here is based on the word yuga, which is related to the English word yoke, which suggests some things that are joined together. So in this case, serenity and insight are yoked together. And as he develops serenity and insight in conjunction or yoked together, the path is generated. He then pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. And as he does so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Okay, we don't find this expression, samatha vipassanam yuga nadang, explicit, to my knowledge, it's not explicitly explained within the Nikayas themselves. A very early work, which has a commentarial flavor, included in the Sutta Vitaka, is called the Patisambhita Magga. And this gives one explanation, which I'll just look at briefly here. In fact, the Patisambhita Magga has a whole chapter called Yuga Nada Vago. It's a whole chapter which is a kind of analysis and explanation of this sutta spoken by the Venerable Ananda. And when it comes to Yuga Nada, actually, I have to say the explanation is not so clear to me. It says, in 16 modes, one develops samatha, vipassana, yuganada, bound together. Then the 16 modes, this is pretty scholastic, it says, in the sense of the object, with respect to the object, with respect to the range, with respect to abandoning, with respect to relinquishment, with respect to emergence, with respect to turning away, with respect to excellence, with respect to freedom from the Asavas, with respect to crossing over, with respect to the signless, with respect to the desireless, with respect to emptiness, with respect to one flavor, with respect to not exceeding, with respect to not exceeding one another. Okay, I have to say this, not so clear in itself, but then the next chapters give some explanation of these terms. Okay, so how, I'll just go through this very briefly, just taking one or two of these examples. So how does one develop insight, how does one develop samatha and vipassana yoked together with respect to the object? Okay, in this case, for one abandoning restlessness, there is one pointedness of mind, non-distraction, or samadhi, which has cessation as its object, nirodha aramana. And for one abandoning ignorance, there is insight in the sense of contemplation or observation, anupassana pena, having cessation as its object. Thus, there is samatha and vipassana having one flavor, ekarasa, with respect to the object. So in this way, they are yoked together and do not exceed one another. So that is what is meant when it is said, one develops samatha and vipassana yoked together with respect to the object. So the Patisambhita Magga, in my understanding, is speaking here about the experience in the supramundane or world-transcending state of consciousness, the what's called the world-transcending path. In that state of mind, or that state of mind takes Nibbana as its object. So that's why it's said that it has cessation as its object. And in that state, there is samadhi, which consists in the abandoning of restlessness, because restlessness is the opposite of one-pointedness or concentration. And there is the abandoning of ignorance, because ignorance is the opposite of true knowledge or insight. But definitely, the Patisambhita Magga is speaking here not about the normal sequence of development, but what happens when one reaches the world-transcending path by developing serenity and insight. So on this understanding, I would have to say, in order to reach that world-transcending experience, that supramundane experience, one would have to have approached it either by beginning with serenity and moving on to insight, or by beginning with insight and then supplementing it with serenity, with concentration. But what's interesting is that the commentary to the Patisambhita Magga doesn't actually comment on the Patisambhita's explanation of the passage from the Anguttara Nikaya Sutta. Is this getting too complicated?
No.
Okay. But the commentary to the Patisambhita Magga explains this passage from the sutta. In a different way. Okay, what the Patisambhita Magga commentary says is that it says that one does not it is not possible to investigate conditioned phenomena with the very same consciousness by which one enters into a meditative attainment, like the jhanas or the formless meditations. But rather, it says, what one does is enter each meditative attainment, starting with the first jhana, and then one emerges from that meditative attainment, and then one investigates the sankharas, the conditioned phenomena, with insight. So one starts by attaining the first jhana, one emerges, investigates the conditioned phenomena, sees them as impermanent, suffering, non-self. Then one enters the second jhana, investigates, emerges, investigates the phenomena as impermanent, suffering, non-self. Then one goes on to the third jhana, fourth jhana, all the ways up to the fourth formless meditation, the state called neither perception nor non-perception, neva sanyana sanyayatina. One emerges from that and then investigates the conditioned phenomena. So that is, according to the commentary, it's in that way that one practices serenity and insight yoked together. So it seems even the ancients or early generation of commentators had different modes of understanding of this. Okay, now we come, the fourth one is again a bit puzzling with different ways of explanation. This one says that here amongst, coming back to the original Anguttara Nikaya Sutta, here amongst mind is seized or gripped by restlessness about the Dhamma. Dham udaccha vigahitang manasang hoti. But there comes an occasion when his mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and concentrated. Then the path is generated in him. He pursues the path, develops it, and so on. And then his fetters are abandoned, and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Okay. The Patisambhita Magga, again, explains this by way of what it called the 10 imperfections of insight, or 10 corruptions of insight, which are phenomena that arise when one is developing very deep insight meditation, such as a bright light, exceeding joy and bliss, or very powerful serenity, or deep penetrative insight. And then sometimes one gets distracted by that, and one takes that to be the path, and then one gets sort of infatuated with one's experiences, and one loses the correct path of insight contemplation. So the Patisambhita Magga, together with the Visuddhi Magga, say that when this happens, one should leave off that infatuation with these very unusual experiences and come back to the observation of impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And so this is the way they explain the mind being seized by restlessness about the Dhamma, and by coming back to the path of insight, they explain, as the mind becomes steady, composed, unified, and concentrated. But I would understand this a little bit differently, and this, again, I have to say this is my personal interpretation. I would take this kind of case to be exemplified by some disciples who maybe were trying to penetrate the Dhamma, either intellectually, or maybe they had misinterpreted their experiences of insight to be the true realization. And then when they realized that they had not reached realization, their mind became restless and they couldn't settle down. Maybe a case, an example of this would be the case of the ascetic named Bhatia, Bhatia Dharuchirya, who thought he was an arhat. So he must have had some powerful meditative experiences. But then it said in the Udana, Sutta number 10, some friendly deity told him, you haven't really reached arhatship. In fact, you haven't reached anything worth boasting about. And so then when he heard this, Bhatia was confused and said, if I haven't reached anything, then who has reached the real state of arhatship? Then the deity said, in the city of Savati, there is one called the Blessed One, the son of the Sakyans. He is the Buddha, the fully enlightened one. Go to him. He's the one who's reached arhatship and could show you the path to arhatship. And so Bhatia was so sort of shaken by this revelation that he set out straight for Savati, going as far as his feet would take him each day, and setting out early the next day till he reached Savati. He found out that the Buddha was wandering for alms in the town. And so he didn't even wait for the Buddha to come back, but he went straight into Savati, found the Buddha walking through the streets, and said to him, teach me the Dhamma. And the Buddha said, this isn't the time for teaching, Bhatia. Wait till I finish my alms round. We go back to the monastery together, then I can teach you. But Bhatia insisted 3 times, teach me, teach me, teach me. Each time the Buddha said, be patient and wait. Then Bhatia said, you know, I don't know how long I can live. I could die at any moment. Please teach me. So then the Buddha said, okay, in that case, I'll teach you. Then the Buddha gave him a very, very concise teaching. And as soon as Bhatia heard it, right on the spot, he went from the stage of being a worldling to the stage of arhatship. So it seems in a case like that, that his mind was seized by this restlessness about the Dhamma. He can't even wait for the Buddha to finish his alms round. But probably when the Buddha starts teaching him, when he hears the instruction, then his mind settles down, becomes steady, unified, concentrated. Then he penetrates the instruction right on the spot. So that's my understanding of this. Okay, so these are the 4 ways of developing serenity and insight. I want to take a look now at another text from the Anguttara Nikaya, which elaborates on this pattern in a way that gives us some indications of what's involved in developing serenity and insight. Here we have to go down a little further in the handout. This will be taking 493, explains 4 types of persons. This explains it in brief, but I want to move on past this to go to the next of the 494, which takes these 4 kinds of persons in detail. And here it's the Buddha who's speaking, and he says that there are these 4 kinds of persons found existing in the world. Okay, what are the 4? Okay, there's one person who gains internal serenity of mind, but not the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. So here we have somewhat more complex expressions of serenity and insight, samatha and vipassana. So internal serenity of mind is ajatang, within oneself. Chaito means of the mind, samatha, serenity. But not the higher wisdom. Actually, I have these terms in the previous sutta, so we could just scroll up to get them. To page 5. We have here, we can see, ajatang chaito samatasa, of internal serenity of mind. Then the next one, the higher wisdom of insight into dharmas, into phenomena. Adi panya dhamma vipassana. So here, vipassana, insight, is unfolded or unpacked as insight into what? Into the nature of dhammas, phenomena. And that insight into phenomena is what brings the adipanya, the higher wisdom. Okay, so there's one person, going back to 494, so one person gains this serenity of mind, but not the higher wisdom of insight. So this one, the Buddha says, some other person gains the higher wisdom of insight, but not the internal serenity of mind. Still another gains neither internal serenity of mind nor the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. And then the fourth person gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Okay, now the Buddha's specific instructions for each of these types of persons. The person who gains internal serenity of mind, but not the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. So this would correspond in Venerable Ananda's scheme to which person? It would be the person following the first model, the one who develops insight, preceded by serenity. So this person should, who gains internal serenity or samadhi, but not the higher wisdom of insight, should approach one who gains insight and phenomena, and he should ask certain questions. These are the questions that he should ask. What did I hit? Okay, I put this in the answer book. He asked, how, friend, should conditioned phenomena be seen? How should conditioned phenomena be explored or investigated? How should conditioned phenomena be discerned by insight? And then the person who's guiding him should explain according to his own practice and experience thus. Conditioned phenomena should be seen in such and such a way. They should be explored or investigated in such and such a way. They should be discerned by insight in such and such a way. And for those who know Pali, it's interesting to look at the Pali here. So the subject of all of these terms is sankhara, conditioned phenomena, which would refer to the phenomena of generally the five aggregates, or it could be the internal or outer sense bases, whatever scheme of contemplation the meditator is using. But we have first dattva, which is based on the verb pasati, to see, or the other verb, dasati, to see. How should they be seen? Then another verb, samasitava, which is based on a root meaning mas, which means literally to touch or to stroke. It suggests something going a little more deeper or more thorough than simply seen. And then the third term here, vipassitava, is also based on the verb pasati, but because it has the prefix v, it indicates excellence or depth. So there seems to be a certain purpose behind the sequence, that one starts off with seeing the nature of the conditioned phenomena. Maybe this will be a lower stage of insight, or even the stage when one is getting instructions on how to consider, maybe conceptually, the five aggregates, how to consider them in terms of one's intellectual understanding or initial contemplation. But as the contemplation becomes stronger and more experiential, then one comes into exploration or investigation. One is sort of seeing them continuously from moment to moment as they're arising and passing away, and one is starting to ascribe the three characteristics to these conditioned phenomena. And then as the insight gains, or the investigation gains more momentum, then one is seeing them with very clear, penetrative insight. So this could be what is suggested by the term vipassitabba, seeing with vipassana, with real higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Okay, so this is the person, we could say, who's following, before I said mistakenly, the first model that Ananda explained. I'm sorry, this is the person who gains the first model. Okay, now we come to number two. Yeah. This is the person who gains the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, but not internal serenity of mind. This is the one who follows Ananda's second model. So one who gains insight, but not yet serenity. So this is one who is practicing serenity preceded by insight. Vipassana pubangamang samatang bhaveti. So this person knows how to develop insight, but he has to learn how to develop stronger samadhi, stronger concentration. So he has to approach a teacher who gains serenity of mind, somebody who is skilled in samadhi, and he asks, how, friend, should the mind be steadied? How should the mind be composed? How should the mind be unified? How should the mind be concentrated? And then his guide or mentor will explain to him it's in such and such a way that the mind should be steady, in such a way that the mind should be composed, in such a way unified, in such a way concentrated. Again, we have a sequence of terms here which seem to be laid out in a sequence. So sun tappe tappang suggests the idea of placing the mind on an object. It's based on the verb tappeti, the causative form of titati, of to stand. So how should the mind be placed on the object so that it stays on the object? Then there comes sannisitabbang, which is based on the verb sannisitadeti, which means literally to cause to sit. It's based on the verb sitati, to sit down, or sadeti, or nisadeti, to cause to sit down. So when one sits down, one is steadier than somebody who is standing in one place. So one is now sitting on the object. So now one is remaining more steadily on the object. But still, perhaps the mind, though it's sitting steadily on the object, but it's not yet well focused. So next comes the third stage, chitang ekodikattabbang, that the mind should be unified on the object. So unification implies a still further stage in collecting the mind, in making the mind one-pointed. And then we come to the fourth stage, evang chitang samadhatta, samadhatabang. This form is based on the verb samadhiyati, which is related to the noun samadhi. So in other words, how does one gain samadhi? And the teacher explains, in such a way one gains samadhi. So one is progressing here from the stage of making the mind persistently stand upon the object to making the mind settle down upon the object, to unifying the mind on the object, to gaining samadhi, or deep concentration, based on that object. Okay, now I'm going to pass over some of the other texts that I laid out, though all of them will be useful to you, so don't neglect them. But I want to come back to my outline. To come to section 4 of my outline, and here I speak about two models of the path that one finds in the suttas themselves. Or at least the way I understand it, I see two models here. One is a model that one sees in many suttas, especially in the Majjhima Nikaya. We find this model, I say the basic pattern for this model, one could find in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 27, in number 51, and with slight variance on this model, in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 39, number 53, number 107, and then another version of it, very similar, in Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Fours, Sutta 198. And this is the model of what is sometimes called the graduated step-by-step training, the Anupubha Sika. In this model, we see a disciple begins by gaining faith in the Tathagata, the Buddha, and his teaching. He goes forth into the homeless life. He takes up the training in the silas, the modes of virtuous conduct, the precepts. Then he moves on to contentment, restraint of the senses, sometimes added from some of the other versions is the practice of vigilance and restraint, moderation in eating, and vigilance through the day and the night. Then comes also the training in mindfulness and clear comprehension in one's day-to-day activities. Then one goes off into seclusion, finds a quiet, secluded place for meditation. Then one overcomes the five hindrances. One develops in sequence the four jhanas, the four types of meditative absorption. Then after gaining the fourth jhana, in most versions one gains what are called the three higher knowledges, the recollection of past lives, the divine eye in order to see the passing away and rebirth of beings in accordance with their karma, and then one turns the mind to the eradication of the asavas, the influxes, outflows, or taints. So in this gradual step-by-step training is obviously following the model that puts initial emphasis on serenity. So one uses samadhi or samatha to enter the four jhanas, and also it's on the basis of samatha and the jhanas that one develops the recollection of past lives and the knowledge of the passing away of rebirth of beings. And then even though insight is not specifically mentioned here, but to reach the destruction of the defilements, the destruction of the asavas, one has to develop insight, and that insight reaches its culmination in the direct seeing of the Four Noble Truths, which is mentioned in this particular version of the path. And as one sees the Four Noble Truths, then it said the mind is liberated from the asava or influx of sensuality, the influx of bhava, of craving for existence, and the influx of ignorance. And then with the liberation from the influxes, one knows one is liberated, and one sounds the lion's roar of liberation. So that is the common model often laid down in the suttas. Now, the way I see it, we find another model that could be taken to emphasize insight, and this would be the model that is derived from the four Satipatthanas, the four foundations or establishments of mindfulness. So we have the basic text for this to be Digha Nikaya Sutta number 22, what's called the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, the larger discourse on the establishments of mindfulness, and Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 10, the classical sutta on the establishments of mindfulness. And in addition to these two basic texts, we find the collection of short texts on the foundations of mindfulness in the Samyutta Nikaya. This is chapter 47. Now, when we speak about the four foundations of mindfulness as a model that emphasizes insight, it doesn't mean that the four foundations of mindfulness are exclusively directed to insight. One could also use the four foundations of mindfulness to develop samatha, especially through the practice of mindfulness of breathing. And it's said that the contemplation of the 32 parts of the body, 31 parts of the body, can also lead to samadhi or even to the first jhana. But I think the emphasis in the practice of Satipatthana is on the development of insight. And so we find, at least in contemporary Burma and probably in other countries, generations, but over many generations, the Satipatthana Sutta as the classical text used for the model of practice in which one develops insight first, and then based on that insight, one will go on to develop serenity, further concentration, in order to strengthen the insight to the point where it can reach the supramundane path, the world-transcending path. Okay, I'm not going to go any further. I'm not going to explain the foundations or establishments of mindfulness in detail, but just to indicate that in my understanding, we can pick up these suttas and see them as the classical texts that serve as the original sources or fountainheads for these two systems of meditation practice. So the teachers who emphasize first attaining the jhanas and then developing insight will pick out the graduated step-by-step training. And then the teachers who emphasize going very directly into the practice of insight will be those who draw upon the Satipatthana Sutta. But what's interesting is that neither the suttas on the gradual step-by-step training, nor the suttas, nor the Satipatthana Sutta speak about what one has to understand with insight. For that, one has to turn to the suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya especially, that speak about the three characteristics. That would be the suttas that speak about the five aggregates in Samyutta Nikaya chapter 22, the suttas that speak about contemplating the six internal and external sense bases, that would be Samyutta Nikaya chapter 35, and the suttas that speak about contemplating the elements, the four elements or the six elements, that would be Samyutta Nikaya chapter number 14. And what all of these suttas have in common, or at least the main, the repeated lesson from these suttas, is that to gain insight, one should contemplate whether the five aggregates, the six sense bases, or the four or six elements, one is to contemplate them in terms of the three marks, the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, non-self. One could either usually take up one of these marks as one's primary focus, and then just the other marks will naturally arise through such contemplation, or else one can move sequentially, going from impermanence to suffering, and from both to non-self. Okay, what one finds in the suttas is that even though Samatha and Vipassana can be, in theory, separated, but generally the Buddha places emphasis on developing both of them. So one finds in some of the other suttas that I selected, for example, from the Majjhima Nikaya, one finds the Buddha speaks about developing both serenity and insight. But when we come to the commentarial treatment of Samatha and Vipassana, we see how these two modes of meditation practice come to be taken as branching off to form two different paths that the meditator can follow, either one or the other. And sort of the classical explanation of these two models is the Visuddhi Magga in chapter 18. Let me just take my copy of Visuddhi Magga. Oh, this blows out. Okay, the Visuddhi Magga says that after it has the long chapter explaining the jhanas and all of the other higher attainments of serenity or samadhi, it says, one who wants to begin developing insight, if his model is serenity or samatha, he first gains any of the fine material jhanas, the rupa jhanas, or the immaterial jhanas. That's the four immaterial states, the base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, or neither perception nor non-perception. Actually, he doesn't take the base of neither perception nor non-perception, but he goes up to the base of nothingness, and then he should discern according to their characteristic and function and so on, the jhana factors involved in those states. The jhana factors like applied thought, sustained thought, rapture, bliss, and one-pointedness of mind. Then he examines all of the factors together there, and then he distinguishes them in terms of nama and rupa, mentality and materiality. And then from there, he goes into the contemplation of insight. But then the Visuddhimagga says, one whose vehicle is pure insight, or one who begins with serenity but wishes to use insight as his method, discerns the four elements in brief or in detail, and then it gives elaborate instructions. And then from the four elements, one goes on to examine all of the other aspects of material form, and then the different aspects of the different mental factors, and groups them into the five aggregates or six sense bases, and then into name and form. So we find that in the system of the Visuddhimagga, which is the classical Theravada system, we have one sequence of practice for the samatha meditator who begins with one or another jhana and then uses that jhana as the basis for insight. And then another approach for the vipassana meditator who doesn't attain the jhana but begins directly by practicing insight on the mental and material phenomena of the body and the mind. And for both of them, the achievement of liberation through the supramundane paths and fruits depends on the development of insight. But in the first model, insight is based on an attainment of samadhi. On the second model, there is no attainment of jhana or formless attainments, but rather the samadhi that develops is a kind of momentary samadhi which arises through the practice of insight meditation. Okay, this should be my basic presentation. I don't know how we're doing in terms of time.
We are fine with time, Bhantavis. We can... I mean, the presentation was wonderful. I really enjoyed it. And I think we can just conclude at this point, and if the students have any kind of questions, they can put it up on the blog we have, and then be discussed there.
Okay.
I appreciate the Patisamnitamaga part.
Okay.
The thing on Yogananda has always been puzzling me.
The what?
The thing on Yogananda. Samatha Vipassana Yogananda.
Yeah, it's still not completely clear to me. But what's interesting, one of the suttas that I didn't get to read from, let me just get my outline. It's the one from Majjhima Nikaya number 149, the Great Sixfold Base. It's speaking about one who is... Yeah, like I put the Pali in there deliberately because it says that one who's contemplating in this way has these two things, samatha and vipassana, occurring yuganada, yoked evenly together. And then from there he goes on to fully understood the things to be fully understood, to abandon the things that should be abandoned, to develop the things that should be developed, and to realize the things that should be realized. And then the things that should be developed according to the same sutta, but again according to the following Sanyutta Nikaya sutta. There's the sutta on the guest house, number 159. What are the things to be developed by direct knowledge? At the end are samatha and vipassana.
Yeah.
So in a way those things sort of summarize the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so I think we did all right.
Good, then. Thank you very much for...
Okay. But do I have to do anything with the recording now?
With now this, we are switching off,
Pandit. Audacity.
Thank you very much. For
do I click the yellow button now?
Yes.
Or you have the